Welcome to the Way Forward Regenerative Conversations podcast number 6, Business and Regeneration, a conversation with Coann Vickeren Skuringerds. I'm Jim Burke, the producer. In this episode, we explore the role of business in moving the paradigm from sustainability to regeneration in our response to the crises of our time. Corporations, which are exclusively focused on profit, market share, and growth, have rightfully earned much of the distrust that the public feel. Continuous growth on a finite planet appears ludicrous to many now. Can businesses and corporations reinvent themselves for the challenges of the 21st century? In this far-reaching podcast, we explore how the organization, Sustainable Life Media, Sustainable Brands, has been at the forefront of leading the way to help corporations become more sustainable and regenerative. We learn how business often has more flexibility, international reach, and resources to lead change initiatives than governments do. Our guest, Coann Vickeren Skuringerds, is founder and CEO of Sustainable Life Media Sustainable Brands. She found the organization because she and a few others saw the need for business to adopt system thinking and address sustainability. A longtime friend of our host, Dr. John Izzo and Alain Gauthier, she was instrumental in bringing them together, which ultimately led to this podcast. Prior to launching Sustainable Life Media in 2004, Coann led a boutique consultancy for 2 years and worked 18 years in business-to-business media organizations. And now I would like to introduce the host of the Way Forward Regenerative Conversations, Dr. John Izzo and Alain Gauthier.
Hi, I'm Dr. John Izzo, and on behalf of my co-host, Alain Gauthier, I want to welcome you to this episode of our podcast, The Way Forward Regenerative Conversations about the Future of Humanity and Planet, where we explore together how we can create a thriving and positive future for humans and the Earth. We want, as always, to explore what is the way forward. We don't have the answers. But we hope to stimulate all of us to imagine what's possible, what needs to change, and the role that each one of us can play in it. So great to be here again, Alain, and really looking forward to our guest today, where we get to explore something that I know we both have been involved in for several decades now, and that is the role that business can and must play and is playing in the way forward. And, you know, I wrote my first book on that subject in 1994, Awakening Corporate Soul. And I think of how much the world has changed since then in terms of the engagement of business leaders on issues around society and ecology. So really excited to have this conversation today.
Yes, indeed. And I've been watching myself progress made, particularly by benefit corporations, trying to look at a different way of doing business that benefits most people, not just the shareholders.
Indeed. And I can't think of anyone I'd rather have in this conversation with us today than a mutual friend, Coann Vickeren Skuringerds, who is the founder of Sustainable Brands. So what I believe is the premier organization in the world, bringing brands, small and large, together to think about how business can be a force for good and do well by doing good. So, Coann, great to have you here with us.
I couldn't be happier to be in conversation with two longtime friends.
So, Coann and John, you were both at the San Diego conference. And what did you come away with in terms of where we are with regeneration and the role of business in it?
Love to hear John's perspective first before I share mine.
Yeah, well, first of all, it was a great conference, as always. You know, several thousand change agents gathering together, and Coann and her team did a beautiful job. I guess the thing that really struck me is I had a dual emotions at the conference. And one was that the challenges that we face continue to become more daunting, especially in terms of ecology. And I felt under the surface, there's just a real recognition of how the clock is ticking and we're in this critical moment. And the second thing is the energy that is there to do something about it. And it left me feeling like maybe a little spiritual moment here that the spirit is willing, but the flesh is still weak, meaning we haven't quite found the way forward, but the desire is there. But there's also a need to not get depressed because the challenge keeps getting so great. So those were, I guess, my two almost conflicting emotions.
Well, and I think reflective of the theme that we chose for the conference this year, which was recenter to accelerate. And that really came about out of a recognition that those of us who've been doing this work for a long time are feeling quite a bit of PTSD about the mounting pressures and evidence of that, that we're all feeling and seeing and hearing and reading about every day on the environmental and social and political side. And that the fear that can come from that, and I will say personally, I think I disclosed in my opening remarks that this year has been a year when for the first time I have been struggling to a degree with fear that we're not going to make it, but that fear is not a helpful emotion and that we have to figure out how to get it in check. And we need to make sure that we focus on giving ourselves time to have that personal transformation, recenter and recognize that this is not the first time that the world has been through crises and that we do know a lot. And that if we all stay focused on the goal, we do have hope of getting there. So I hear you on that front. I feel the same dichotomy for sure.
It's always a good reminder too, isn't it, Glenn, that like we have those of us always in the present moment, we feel our crisis is like no other crisis ever before. I have a 87-year-old friend I play tennis with, still plays singles at 87, only singles.
Crazy.
But he's a real buff of history. And I told him I was giving a talk to leaders about, you know, engaging talent and customers in an age of disruption. And he said, oh, you mean like the Holocaust or like the Cultural Right. Revolution? And I said, well, no, not really. So, you know, I think it is important that we have that inner perspective that, yes, we're in a time of crisis, but if we lean too deeply into that feeling of crisis, it's paralyzing rather than enabling. So, I'm curious. We're going to talk in a minute about why you started Sustainable Brands, but I'm curious, how do you stay on that knife's edge yourself? You know, what keeps you from going to the dark side, if you will, around losing that sense of hope?
Well, two things. One is that I hold on to faith. And I think at the end of the day, whether or not we're spiritually driven people of faith or not, we all are required to have some amount of faith. You either you choose to hope or you choose to give up. And giving up is not valid. There's no hope of getting there if you give up. So, I mean, for me, hope and faith are not a choice. They're the only obvious decision to commit to. And then the second thing is just the strength of our community and the progress that we're making, even though we can look at the glass as half empty, I also see it as half full. And I think one of the things I observed out of San Diego this year was a sense for me of a bit of crossing the chasm in the sense that for the first time, and not because we did anything different from a marketing standpoint, we saw companies like Procter & Gamble and Amazon and Target and others bringing two dozen and more people, cross-functional people to the conference. You know, P&G had 30 people there this year, and they crossed multiple business units and multiple functions. And this is a reflection of the fact that they really understand both the problem and the opportunity space, and that they really are committed now to a whole systems shift internally and also culture change externally. So that gives me hope. I came away feeling a lot more comfortable and happy and hopeful than I went into the week.
So what did lead you to found Sustainable Brands? And was there a kind of turning point at one time where you said, yes, this is what is needed now?
It's a hard question to ask in a limited podcast because it's a semi-long answer, but the high-level reason was that I just really strongly felt that the narrative at the time, which said that business was the enemy of our future, was a defeatist narrative, and that if we could, that we needed to engage our economy in a way that was beneficial to the economy in solving the problem. And I also really believed that brands uniquely sit at the intersection of the economic ecosystem and have the unique opportunity to evolve the ecosystem in alignment with, you know, a future that benefits all stakeholders, and that ultimately the market drivers would be such that they had to do that. So, you know, what led me to start it was I couldn't convince anyone else to do it. and I felt so strongly, you know, driven by Peter Senge's creative tension that I didn't have a choice, really.
That's great. There's a great line from Jerry Garcia of Grateful Dead fame. I don't even know what he was talking about, but he said it was obvious that something had to be done. It was just incredibly pathetic. It had to be us to do it.
Right? Yeah.
So sometimes that is what motivates us, isn't it? As we realize someone's got to step up and do something.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, it was an act of faith for me. I just really felt the need and desire to be of service to the universe and trusted that if I offered myself in service to the universe would honor that in some way. And that's really the shorthand version.
Yeah.
Lots of intellectual kind of sparks over time that led me to the realization, lots of them. And Alon, you were one of those people. You have been such a gift to me over the years and helping me understand value networks and other things and organizational learning and so many aspects of the path to the future that we have to absorb and operationalize. So I thank you for that.
Yeah, thank you. Well, there was indeed the question of who influenced you most. You mentioned Peter Senge and his work, especially in the early days. What was it like to move in that direction? And were some very good influences on you?
Well, Peter in the 90s, for sure, and Thomas Friedman's couple of books, Lexus and the Olive Tree and Hot, Flat, and Crowded, really sparked that kind of high-level recognition that my instincts were grounded in reality. And then interesting folks like Francis Fukuyama, I think his name is, who wrote a great book on trust and the importance of trust and social cohesion going forward. And several other, Charles Handy was a writer that I took a lot from. But then it was Bill McDonough and his co-author, Michael Brungart, reading Cradle to Cradle, that really struck me as an answer to the path forward. I'd read a lot of Paul Hawkins' work before that and recognized the problem and the opportunity for influence that business had. But Bill's work and Michael's work on, visioning a circular economy was a spark of a solution that I felt like I could wrap my head around.
Maybe it's also a question about how things have changed. What was it like in the early days to even engage people in business in this conversation? And how have you seen that transition? I've got a story around that too, but you go first. What was it like and how has it changed in terms of engaging business people in this?
Well, I would say at the early days that there was no felt need for this work. And so it wasn't something that you could approach from a traditional, business strategy. And it really was about presenting an authentic and transparent story that I felt strongly enough about and getting it out in front of the people who, for whatever psychographic reason, understood and felt the same intuitive concern and were intrigued with the thesis of what was possible. And those people came, again, more because they were personally aligned with the problem space and wanted to be involved in the conversation, not at all because they were mandated by business to go figure out how to solve the problem. We certainly targeted people who were traditionally mostly in the sustainability or CSR space because those people did understand the problem and did want to figure out how to do something about it. Today, again, there's more felt need of the market drivers that we said were going to come down the road. There's more of a recognition of and proof points for growth opportunities coming out of innovation to solve environmental and social problems. And there is more of the stakeholders are putting pressure on companies to do this work, which enables those people who want to do the work to be justified in, in investing into it, time and energy and creative thought and so forth. So that's great. And it's come a long ways. We always anticipated we would need to involve the whole system in the conversation and try to break down the siloed way of looking at the world. And today we're seeing cross-functional, cross-system participation in a conversation that is a systems conversation. And that's, I think, a meaningful change. I mean, at the beginning of the millennia, if I talked about systems thinking, I got blank stares mostly. Okay. Today, I would say everybody in our community at least gets what systems thinking is and why it's important and why it's necessary for solving the complex problems that we're currently facing. So that's meaningful and gives us hope, right?
Yeah. First on something you said that's so important. I've often thought that, you know, whenever a change effort is happening, people always want to start with the least ready. But actually, that's not the way change works. If you look at social movements, whether it's abolition or environmental movements, they always begin with, or even brands, you know, mm-hmm. how Apple, there's a few followers at the beginning who are really passionate. So I think what I hear you say is you started with the people who were most ready, which I think is always, you know, if someone's listening inside their own company and there isn't energy yet around regeneration or sustainability, I know one of my pieces of advice would be start with the people who are most ready.
And I think that's really wise and helpful. Yeah.
One of my funniest stories about the early days, which gets at the inner work you were talking about, was when Awakening Corporate Soul came out in 1994, I had all kinds of crazy reactions. I'd be at airports, have my book, and someone, flight attendants or gate agents would say, corporate soul, isn't that like an oxymoron? Like corporations are evil, right? But the other thing was I was in the running with the Speakers Bureau be a keynote speaker at a large financial institution. So the senior vice president said, well, send me a copy of his book, which the agent did. Long story short, he called about a week and a half later, said, send me 6 more copies of that book, which the agent took as a very good sign that I would surely be the keynote speaker. Then weeks and weeks went by, and the guy wasn't returning his voicemails. Finally, he gets a hold of him. Hey, you know, did you get the books? Oh, yeah, it's a great book. I love the book. He said, are you going to book Dr. Izzo for the speech? He said, no, we won't be doing that. And he said, well, why not? He said, I thought you said you love the book. He said, yeah, I love the book. He said, it's making me think actually I should quit my job and do something more important. He said, and I've given it to everybody I know. He said, and I quote, but it would not be good for my career to suggest a speaker who had the word soul in the title of his book.
Yeah.
And the beautiful thing is how far we've come now, right? In terms of just the acceptance, as you said, that this is not only a business imperative, but I think for many, more business leaders than the average person would expect, as a moral imperative as well.
Well, and also a human experience and spiritual mm-hmm. imperative. I mean, the reality is that we all have depth to our humanity that we have been asked to check at the door at work, and nobody wants to be doing that. We just have been taught to assume that that was the right way to be. And in fact, the more culture changes and people shift away from having a comfort in addressing their spiritual needs in other settings or in other institutions for whatever set of reasons, the more there's a hunger for that, and the more there's an opportunity for businesses to create a space for whole humans to show up at work. And by the way, isn't that a great big catalyst for business innovation and attracting talent and keeping talent? So it's a win-win-win to be able to have that whole human conversation. And I mean, to your point, how great is it to be able to open a conversation with room full of 1,200 business executives from all the biggest multinational companies out there with a spoken word poem by a poet mm-hmm. and by the chief sustainability officer at Procter & Gamble talking about love as the imperative. I mean, that's mm-hmm. we have come a long ways to be able to do mm-hmm. that. And I'm excited about that.
Well, so let's have a conversation about the difference for you between and for us between sustainability and regeneration. Mm-hmm. If I start with, for instance, Jim and I, we named the unit, the action group within EAN, Elders mm-hmm. Action Network, which sponsors this. It was called Elders for Sustainable Living. Mm-hmm. Jim particularly felt at one time that it was the time to call it Elders for Regenerative Living.
Love that.
And now we have a program being brought out, which is called the Regenerative Elder Process. So from your perspective, and when does the word regeneration started appearing in your conversations?
That's a great question. I will say that one of the early debates that I got in naming the company was whether or not to focus it on green versus sustainability on one hand, and on the other hand, whether sustainability was not a right frame for the objective of the work. And certainly Bill McDonough and Michael Brungardt were very vocal about their belief that sustainability was not a good term to use. Oh. And I agreed with them. I mean, first of all, the concept of sustainability being an integrated systems conversation about the intersection between humans and the environment, right? An inextricably linked conversation has taken more than a decade to kind of land with people, and it still hasn't landed. My view about why we chose sustainable brands as a place to start was because mostly the world didn't know that we weren't sustainable. So the first thing we had to do was, we are not sustainable in the way that we're operating. Then we had to work on, and we're still working on, the definition of sustainability is far greater than just environmental, you know, solutions and mitigation, mm-hmm. right? Now, because we have been in this conversation for so long and have a community of people who've been listening and learning for a long time, we have the opportunity to open the conversation about really what the goal is and the need is to get to a thrivable future, which is creating regenerative human and environmental systems. And what's exciting to me is that I think it really wasn't, we chose the theme of regeneration in, I want to say 2019, we planned to use it in 2020, hadn't heard anybody in the public really talk about that term at that time. You know, I'm always looking at the fringes and I'm reading the fringes, tea leaves at the fringes. And I felt strongly enough that we were at a place where enough people would respond to that with intrigue to set it as an agenda for 2020, but not because anybody in our community was using the term. Then we had COVID and we had to drop the 2020 event. And by 2021, the conversation is everywhere. And now the pace at which the conversation around regenerative systems has emerged has been really quite inspiring and also just indicative of the pace of kind of change that's going on right now. So
Paul Hawkins' book, Regeneration, came out about that time, I think.
Yes.
2020, and we interviewed him here in the network. Yep. So how have people responded to this new term? In a, I would say, traditional business world, but you're not dealing with traditional businesses. You're dealing with businesses who are trying to do something beyond the tradition.
Yeah. Well, I think the fact that we have been really popularizing and talking about nature as an inspiration for solutions for a long time with people like Bill and Janine Benyus and others, the transition to really understanding what regeneration is all about is reasonably comfortable in our community, and it makes sense to them. So there's a lot of readiness. And I mean, just the explosion of work in regenerative ag that's come online with a cross-sector of members of our community, which include, you know, people from Walmart, General Mills, to the banking sector, to all kinds of small farm holders, to, you know, the whole part of the ecosystem is coming together in a new way. And that's really exciting.
John?
Yeah. You know, one of my thinking around regeneration is, well, actually, I want to go back to something you said, Coanne, that is so important about the fringe. Because it often occurs to me, if you want to know where the future is going, pay attention to the fringe,
yes.
Right? So whether it was in the 1960s, like you pay attention to the fringe, winds up being the mainstream, right? And so if you want to be ahead of the things, to pay attention to the fringe. And I love that you said you were hearing from the fringe, if you will, and here in a positive sense, the fringe is the frontier of innovation. That people were thinking it's not enough to be sustainable. We need buildings to be regenerative, agriculture to be regenerative. We need social systems generative. Mm-hmm. And this idea that they would actually make life more likely to flourish rather than just, well, let's keep it at the level that we're at. And clearly now there's a need for regeneration, because the all of our systems, you know, we had another guest on who really talked about, I forget the four systems, maybe you remember a lot, education, ecology, anyway, I forget the, but when he went through these, we were, all these four systems were degenerated, all right?
100%.
And so we need this regeneration. And I love also you said that word sustainable was so strongly associated with just green, you know, regardless of the cost for humans. And I was even guilty of that in my early environmental days, you know, damn the people, save the trees, right? And then you realize, I didn't quite feel that way, but that's kind of how it came across to people, right?
Yeah, well, I think you still find that construct and mental model inside lots and lots of companies, and I would say almost most of them, even, and that's just a function of legacy, right? Companies for so often had corporate social responsibility, which focused on community and human mm-hmm. well-being and environmental safety and health separate. And because they're so organizationally, you know, in the structure is organizationally embedded, even when they will acknowledge that the two things are inextricably linked, they struggle to reorganize their yes. conversation and their organization in such a way that combines the two in a meaningful way. But that is happening.
Yeah. And whenever they're organizationally separate, they also means they compete with each other for resources.
Yes,
and
so exactly.
that they're making yes. the case. So, exactly. So Coann, what in your mind might a regenerative brand or company look like? What if you could paint a picture of how it would be different than maybe business as usual? What in your mind would be the characteristics of a regenerative company or brand?
Well, I think for me, it's helpful to just talk about the continuum between sustainability and net positive and regeneration, mm-hmm. maybe.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Sustainability seeks to assume the sustenance of the current model, right? And we've already agreed that the current model is not sustainable, right? So then we start exploring the question of, well, what does it mean to create a system that is sustainable? And we get to the conversation about net zero or then net positive, right? Okay, well, if we can stop taking away so many resources from the earth or emitting carbon that is creating climate change that is leading to all the disasters that we're facing, then maybe we will have arrived. Then we became to realize that getting to net zero is also not good enough because our natural mm-hmm. systems and our political systems and our education systems and everything are not properly structured for the rebuilding of our human and environmental resource. And then you go to net positive. Well, net positive says, okay, you got to aim towards as a company or as an institution or as a person giving back more than you take. That's a nice concept also, but you can give back more than you can take. And that in and of itself does not necessarily create conditions for the systems you're trying to support to take care of themselves when you go away, right? And that's what regeneration is. It's about creating. I mean, I just love the simplicity and power in Janine Benyus's comment that life creates conditions conducive to life, right? That's mm-hmm. what regeneration is about. It's creating conditions conducive to life for the people that you impact and for the environments that you impact as a business. And so at a high level, that's the continuum and the objective. It's a different frame for thinking about things. It's aimed at not giving, giving is kind of the difference between a little bit giving a man a fish and teaching a man to fish, right? Mm. Maybe that's a helpful thing to ponder. Yeah.
And from that perspective, Coann, does regeneration becoming a regenerative business imply that there's a willingness to really challenge the mental models or that many people have had and made them successful? So where do you see, especially among the members of your community, deliberate effort to create conditions where that typical challenge is actually faced?
Yeah, I think, yes, 100%, our mental models have to change and before our institutional models change, right? And I think one of the things that we've been saying for a long time is companies need to start aligning their lobbying and political influence with their commitments to sustainable or regenerative operations, right? And I would say for the first time in our history, we're starting to see an open door for that conversation. I know we have common friends who are working against mm-hmm. that, and we're starting to convene that conversation. The notion of changing the rules of the game has been part mm-hmm. of what we've tried to surface as a need for a long time. And like I said, the encouraging thing is that there's enough people have their head wrapped enough around the pieces of the problem that when you talk about changing the rules of the game, they are able to kind of understand what that might look like or how you translate that into how you're thinking about your supply chains, how you're thinking about your materials, your business models, and how you're thinking about using your influence to support political and regulatory change that's needed to change the rules of the game, because ultimately that's what has to happen.
I'm curious, someone may be listening today who is not kind of immersed in this world of sustainable businesses doing good. So why is it so important? Somebody might say, well, why is it so important that business be involved in this conversation? Isn't it government? Isn't it ultimately the government that's going to make the change? You know, why is it so important that business? I have my own answer, but I'm curious from your perspective, why is it so critical that business be at, if not at the center, close to the center of this change?
I mean, so many reasons, but the biggest for me is just the business as an institution is best equipped to innovate, and changing the world requires innovative thinking and shifting business models. And the institution of business is more clearly focused right now on an outcome. It's easier to shift. First of all, if you can engage the engine within the rules of the game to say that the path to growth in revenues or in profits is through innovation for environmental and social benefit, that's great in and of itself. And the market conditions are becoming such that that is seen and felt. Government can help accelerate that by setting rules that support accelerated transformation. But business doesn't really need that at the end of the day, because they have the opportunity to influence the whole system. Our customers have been telling me forever, well, our customers aren't telling us they want this. And I'm saying, you told the customers what to want, you know, 50 years ago. And you told them that consumption was the path to happiness. And you told them the price was the thing that they should use to differentiate good. And so don't give me that. You can create change in aspiration and what the definition of a good life looks like. And you have to, because, you know, there's no successful business on a dead planet, right? And if your society falls apart, you have no business. So it's nice to be able to say we don't have to rely on altruism. And the reality is that altruism is also self-interest. Like the notion of enlightened self-interest is something you and I have been talking about for a long time, right? And people are starting to get how that works.
Yeah, you know, the other thing that I often think about is that businesses often cut across, especially large businesses like many that you have in sustainable brands, they cut across all the geographies of the planet, right? Whereas government, you know, the UN is really toothless in terms of as an institution to enforce things. But a CEO in the headquarters can make a decision and impact not only that company globally, but the whole supply chain. So I also say to people, business is also not only able to innovate more quickly, but to implement more quickly without the same barriers.
And also see the writing on the wall. They have eyes and ears in various parts of the world, as you say. And so they're able to recognize risk in various parts of the world sooner than others and subtleties of difference. I think I'm excited for the next conversation that we're going to start framing up, which is about regenerating local. I'm seeing now for the first time, though this has been something on my radar for many years, probably almost a decade, I'm seeing the opportunity to open that conversation because of all the supply chain disruptions that happened during COVID, right? And I'm excited about that.
Yeah. Could you say a little more about regenerating local?
Yes. Well, the reality is that all sustainability or regenerative systems are contextually based. And so you can't, one solution does not apply across the board to other solutions. And I firmly believe that in order to become more resilient and adaptable to the changes that are going to continue to happen in the world until we stabilize, local solutions are a necessary part of getting to the future we want. And like I said, the opportunity to have that conversation with a multinational company is new because of supply chain disruption. So then, for example, a lot of the reasons we're having trouble with inflation right now have to do with disruption in supply chain from China. China's got microchip industry or ingredient industry. I mean, just a personal example of that. I had a health issue that was requiring my getting an MRI that had dye associated with the procedure. And it took me 6 months to be able to get that procedure because the state, and it turned out the whole U.S. was out of the dye that is necessary to do this contrast reading and couldn't get it from China. And so that's just one example of all kinds of examples that any of us who are listening to the news hear about the challenges of even keeping the auto industry going. We don't have cars because we don't have microchips for the cars right now. So from a supply chain standpoint, we need to learn how to relocalize. The amount of energy that gets burned in transporting things from place to place is detrimental, and we need to learn how to relocalize. It is not resilient structurally, societally, for us to be continuing to industrialize our economic manufacturing and food systems. And just from the standpoint of trying to really understand the sustainability metrics, how do you identify what science-based target should be for your operations? That depends on where you're sitting. I have a ton of water. I live on the coast of Washington under the Olympic Peninsula in the rainforest. We don't have a water problem here, but I come from California where water is increasingly concerning. Mm-hmm. And so that's another example. The cultural challenges that are faced in a rural setting versus in an urban setting are different. The solutions need to be different. Solutions need to be nurtured and supported at the local level in order for us all to get behind them and for us collectively to thrive, right?
I mentioned the benefit corporations, and I assume you have a few among your members. And I'm wondering whether they are, you know, some of them are small, but some of them are quite big now.
Yeah.
And whether they possibly set an example in a way they are dealing with the challenges that most businesses have in making that big change to.
Sure. People. I mean, you talk about the Patagonias and the Cabot Creameries and some of these, and then the Naturas, who Natura is now publicly held. Definitely these smaller organizations have had the luxury to experiment and take more risks and thus prove out solutions that can be scalable. And that's exciting. You know, there's a resistance to paying attention to a lot of them for a long time because the thesis was that the solution is not applicable to my multinational, right? However, like I said, what multinationals' brands are being increasingly disrupted by pure play, purpose-driven brands, smaller brands, direct-to-consumer brands that have a purpose and meaning at the core of their being. So I remember going to the American National Advertisers Conference for the first time, will be 3 years ago, I guess, now. And there was just a resounding sense of concern about the fact that only 50% of the multinational corporations that were present were growing at all. And all of them were facing disruption by direct-to-consumer startups. So I don't know. They're influencing whether or not people wanted to pay attention to them. They're now having to pay attention to them, I guess.
And it kind of brings in another area, which is, you know, what is the role of the consumer or the individual in helping to move business in this direction? And I'll tell you a story. Tell us. Which is a very profitable telecommunications company in Canada, been a client of ours for many years. And, you know, for example, they have the greenest real estate platform of any company of their size in North America and on, right? They donate more money than almost any other company. But the interesting thing is when they have a big presence in Alberta, and when they took a stand on climate change, they got attacked on Twitter, et cetera, by a lot of people. I'm not going to buy from you anymore, et cetera. And what really occurred to me is, where were the sustainable consumers coming to the brand's side? And it didn't happen, right? And I thought, what a difference it would have made if those customers had gone to Twitter or to social media and say, hey, wait a minute, I love that you guys are doing this, right? Yeah. So I'm just curious, from your perspective, what is the role of the consumer? And what is sustainable brands doing in your companies to, if you will, accelerate the consumer's desire to have this and get them involved in the game?
Yeah. A lot. And I think a number of potential reasons for the situation that you pointed out. We certainly have done research for a long time, and now there's an explosion of research all over the world that says that consumers, by and large, are interested in living more sustainable lifestyles and doing business with brands that are purpose-led and care more about the world than just the profits they're making. The problem is that consumers are confused. They don't feel like they have agency individually. They don't know what to really focus on or speak up about. And they're tired of the social conflict in the conversation. And mm-hmm. so half of what we do is work on helping enable brands to influence consumers in a positive way through helping them focus on understanding what actions are meaningful and through helping them understand how to have a conversation that does not that reads by multiple different sectors of the population. There's no reason to talk about climate change when you're talking to a farmer in the Midwest, because they can see that there's changes in the environment and climate that are impacting their business. You just need to talk about how they can generate more money by using cover crops or taking on some other kinds of regenerative agricultural practices that can generate more profit for them, right? So it's how we have the conversations, what language we use, and how we simplify rather than complexify the asks from the consumers that is the challenge. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can go on about what we're doing about that, but it's long and complex, but we're doing a lot about that.
Yeah, and this is a good time to say this. I was going to say it later, but I'll say it right now. If you are a business person, or you know, a leader in an organization, or a business owner, and you, or just someone who cares about this, and you want to know more, go to Sustainable Brands' website. Go to their conferences. Mm-hmm. They're doing so many things that are innovative and will help you get the tools and things you need. So I'll toot the horn. I mean, I've been on the advisory board at SB. Unpaid, because we all just love what you guys are doing. So I'll put the plug in now because they're doing great things. Well, I may be kind, but I'm not doing it because I'm kind. I'm doing it because it's true, but you're welcome.
Appreciate it.
So, Coran, we had earlier this week Molly Brown, who wrote a book with Joanna Macy called Coming Back to Life. Mm-hmm. And one of the she tends to oppose the industrial growth society to the sustainable society. And is growth something that is a part of the conversations that you have with members of your community?
Yes. And I think there's a lot of, I don't think there's a right answer to that question yet, but there is at least an opening for the debate, because certainly we've been talking about the imperfection and problems with GDP, for example, as a measure of success. And we've been pointing to a lot of different options for thinking about measuring success, gross national happiness, et cetera. So that is something that's in the back of people's minds for sure. And that's, I think, helpful.
So it's coming up as a subject of a conversation.
Yes, absolutely.
But it is a challenge in the business, you know, world, because especially for publicly traded companies, but even privately held ones, you know, but certainly publicly traded ones live and die on their profitability and the numbers growing. You know, there's an addiction to growth. So the whole system, and we have an economist coming on soon, because that's a part of the issue. But, you know, when Patagonia ran those ads, what was it? Don't buy this shirt or don't buy that jacket, right? Which was kind of like an anti-consumer ad for someone who sells, you know, apparel, encouraging people.
And yet their business grew massively as a result of that. And I think the answer to the question is grow what? Right. And I think, you know, we've talked a little bit, we haven't talked, but there's obviously a lot of conversation and exploration going on around circular economy and how possible it is to follow in Unilever's footsteps to drive home the ambition to grow or double your revenues while halving your environmental footprint. And I think that's what gets interesting. You know, obviously, there's a lot of complex and interesting opportunity and challenges in the circularity conversation, because the same thing is true. Circulate what? You know, if you're circulating a lot of toxins in the environment, that's not necessarily helpful. So it's not as simple as just creating a circular economy. But I think there are models for continuing to grow a prosperity. At the same time, we redefine what prosperity means. Mm-hmm. So I think there's possibility for happy, thriving, self-actualized life for humans around the world, for all humans, mm-hmm. and that we can do that without devastating our natural resource in the process.
And there are some models of this already among
us. Yes. That's the exciting thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
The one of the questions we had, but there's little time to discuss it, but especially in these times of elections, etc., the role of businesses and the role of government, is it something that is discussed actively in some of your meetings, or is it also the question about the collective role that businesses can play in evolving these relationships? Do you have anything to say about this?
Well, I think other than what we said earlier in the program, absolutely. I think, you know, again, our friend Elizabeth Doty is now working with our friends at Herb Institute on a whole new program for helping enable positive business influence of political policy. And there's more of that happening. You know, I think whatever you think about the current administration, they have made some great contributions to helping create conditions for a shift in the energy sector, for example, and other things. And I'm honestly pretty hopeful as a result of the elections that we've just had. I think we all had some fear, and any thinking individual can and should have fear about the rise of fascism around the world, not just in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And it is a concern. It's also, to some degree, a natural result of the necessary transition of power and disruption that creates fear that inclines people to retrench into wanting to hold on to old mental models. And all of that's natural. At the same time, how we respond to it is really critical right now. And I mean, for me, the biggest fear is that we don't rise above to a higher human plane. Yes. And seek understanding across the aisle, and rather allow ourselves to fall into this social discord that we have been experiencing the last few years.
Well, we're going to shift more to a personal mode. How do you personally try to live a more regenerative life? We ask this question of all the persons we ask to be our guests. So could you say what comes to you?
Sure. I will say that the biggest challenge and practice that I'm trying to execute, live into, is the recognition that the old adage that says you must put on your own oxygen mask before you help your friend mm-hmm. is actually deeply wise. And I fought that for many, many years, decades of my life. I'm always, you know, like, no, I was given extra strength and therefore I should carry extra weight. And at a certain point, we all will collapse under the weight of the work mm-hmm. that is to be done, because none of us can carry the ball forward on our own. So trying to do a yoga practice every morning and swim or get in the woods, because I can walk out my door and be in the forest today on a daily basis, is a practice I'm trying to be really disciplined about, and I'm doing better at it than I used to. Beyond that, I would say I love this notion of simplicity in the things that we purchase. I believe in the notion of buying durable or lasting quality products that will last forever. I was joking with somebody at the conference last week about how I had to overcome this consumer marketing-based assumption that it was inappropriate to be seen photographed in the same clothes all the time. I've just let that go, because I do show up in photographs around the world, and I don't care. I'm going to buy Eileen Fisher clothing, which is expensive, but lasts me for 15 or 20 years, and not worry about the fact that it's the same black velvet shirt that I always show up in. So that's one. It's kind of bucking the trend for somebody who's in a position of visibility. Very passionate about buying local organic food and services in any way I can. I think I'm pretty passionate about the idea of trying to keep as many of my dollars in our local community as possible. And that's a really interesting exercise once you start diving into it in terms of the whole regenerating local conversation. Yeah. So those are some things. It's beautiful to be in an environment where we can get fresh salmon from the Quinault Indians down the road. And, you know, Steve, I wish I could show you. Steve came home with 6.5 pounds of foraged chanterelles and hedgehogs and other mushrooms yesterday, just in a 40-minute walk that he went out. 6.5 pounds worth. And that's like every day he's coming back with buckets of mushrooms that were freezing and dehydrating and stuff. So that feels really good to be
connected. Oh, that's beautiful. Beautiful. I haven't had lunch yet. You also make me very hungry. So put some butter on those things and one would be in heaven. So Coann, thank you so much for joining us today. So many good things to chew on and think about. We want to thank you for the good work you're doing in the world and also really encourage people who want to know more to go to Sustainable Brands website and I would say go to their conferences and resources as well.
Well, I'm equally delighted that the two of you have found a way to collaborate. You know how much I care about you both, and I long one day to be part of the Elder Network. And so someday I'll hopefully able to put this initiative in someone else's hands and be part of yours. So thank you for including me today.
Well, we'll surely welcome you in. I was thinking of just two things to bring us to a close. You've talked earlier about faith being so important, whether religious or simply a term faith in the more generic sense. And Robert Greenleaf, who of course is famous for having come up with this idea of the servant as leader, which had a big influence in the early days when I first got in this movement in many businesses. And he said that faith was the most important characteristic of a servant leader, because he said the results of the nobler hypothesis almost always happen outside the time frame of your personal view. So that, you know, faith is so important because we may not solve this in our lifetime. You know, I was on the program with Romeo Dallaire, you know, the Canadian general who is famously featured by Nick Nolte in the Hotel Rwanda. And someone asked him the question, when will humans not be at war anymore? And he said, well, I have no idea. He said, it may be 200 years. He said, but we have to think that way. It may not happen in our lifetime. He said, but we must do all we can, that it may take 200 years. He said, but we have to think that way. And that's faith, right? It's not going to happen necessarily in my tenure or my lifetime, but I'm going to do my part. And we want to thank you for doing your part and encourage everyone to do
it. I'm sure that you feel this as I do, that the gift is mine to be able to have the opportunity to live into my purpose. And I encourage everybody to seek that for their own lives.
Great. Wonderful. Lon, any closing comment? Then I'll just close this off.
You said what you said, John. I think the elders, for instance, it said that elders are willing to plant trees, the shade of which they will never enjoy. So that's just another way of saying, and we don't have to wait until we're 60 or 65 to be an elder in that perspective. And that's what I think you were just going to say.
And the corollary is that you don't have to give up having impact when you're no longer in a seat, a business seat or whatever. I think that the power of eldership is something that we need to recapture as a society. So I'm really grateful that you guys are doing this work.
Well, thank you. And a good time to thank one of our sponsors, the Elders Action Network. And thank you, of course, the listeners, for joining us on this podcast. If you like what you've heard today, please share it with others. If you liked it but think we can do better, please send us your comments. We'd love to hear from you, as well as who you would like to have us join our conversation. So on behalf of Alain Gauthier, our great producer, Jim Burke, I want to thank you for listening into the Way Forward podcast. Let's keep having regenerative conversations, and we look forward to seeing you next time. Thanks for joining us.
I want to thank you for taking the time to listen to our podcast, The Way Forward Regenerative Conversations. You have many choices, and we appreciate your interest and support. You can reach us at our email address, thewayforwardrc@gmail.com. I would also like to thank our sponsors, Elders Action Network and Blueprint NGO. Elders Action Network is building a movement of elders to address the environmental, governance, and social issues of our time. Their website is eldersaction.org. Blueprint is catalyzing a global conversation about the state and impact of men in the world. Together, they are mobilizing men to be a force for good. Their website is blueprint.ngo. Until next time, I'm Jim Burke, and this was the Way Forward Regenerative Conversation Podcast, which you can listen to on Podbean and Apple Podcasts.